you, Catherine. Hello, everyone. You can all hear me fine? Okay, let's hope that nothing happens to the power or something, because my voice will just disappear altogether. Anyway, it's lovely to be here. It's my first time at this festival, and I just find it amazing. Everyone's so friendly, but I didn't have any wellies, unfortunately. Anyway, I'm going to read some poems that connect in one way or another, however loosely, with the theme of paradise. And as Catherine says, paradise, the word, comes from the old Persian word. And I'm from Iran, or what was then Persia. And I think also our ideas of paradise come from the East as well. Because imagine, you know, these nomadic people living in these very hot, dry countries with deserts. Of course, their idea of what would be heaven on earth would be, first and foremost, a garden with lots of water and lots of shade and the perfume flowers and lots of beautiful maidens wandering around and houris and all that kind of stuff. So I'm going to start with reading a few garden poems that are not necessarily set in Iran. In fact, this first one is set in Wales, where I went for a writing retreat, and it was a very beautiful garden. And the woman who owned it was, I found, quite strange. She was very, very otherworldly, and we hardly ever saw her. So this was a poem for her, really. The North-Facing Garden, for Jill. I have never seen her in the garden, never heard her gardening, only heard her talk of moonlight walks, perhaps tonight, if the clouds clear. I have heard no one in the garden, heard nothing but the waterfall, fountain, the pitter-patter in steam rise after rainfall that dribbles off at 7. Yet someone must have gardened it, hours, every day for years. The evidence is there, barrow, cuttings, a ladder in the wood. Someone who did it all before we came, like the Indians before Columbus. Like nature before woman stepped, hair dripping like a seal with her infant out of water. Or the invisible footmen of our childhoods, shadow hands that served us. We who were beauty, at the table of the beast, we also were. Here shadows are where colour grows, though only rose, all shades of rose, from the palest of anemone to dogwood, wedlock, or curled in heart's tongue fern. The garden facing north takes its colour not from sun, but from her face, deepening in the evenings, stove-flushed, lamp-lit, waking to a bedroom facing west. "Why, I'm no good in the mornings," she says. Behind the eyes, smile, dip and rise of features that apologize for the poverty of words, stones speak, spirits prove, and with time on her hands, she makes Eden hers, re-entering through a back door, stone propped open, unseen behind an arch, hovering like a shade of our former selves. Thank you very much. I don't know, I go to hundreds of poetry readings, and very often poets, they got this from originally some poet who said, it's okay, please don't clap each poem, because then the poems you don't clap will get jealous. And so anyway, it's up to you. This is a garden poem taken from a painting by Henri Cros, who was a French post-impressionist. And his painting is called In the Luxembourg Gardens. And I just focused on a detail in the corner of the painting, which was two tiny little girls who were sort of crouched down peering at something on the ground. And they were wearing pink. So in the Luxembourg Gardens. If summer had its ghosts, gifts of wind, wind blows to you and whisks away, then these two small girls in pale pink flared like two sweet peas, I would take for mine and twirl them to the balustrade. Look how squatting, peering down, they think the ground a river, a winding in the gravel, whose underwater mysteries, like gaps between our memories, appear and disappear. Like gaps between our memories that reappear through tow ropes, seemingly in reach, then far out, where leaves are light and light is fish, persuade us with a colour, dissuade us with a depth. Twirl them back through leaf litter, parkland, crossroads, up and over chimney stacks, birch smoke, lavender, till, like gaps between our memories, seed and dust and all wind carries, they are seen at such a distance, we think them elemental light, fire, air. I was actually, when Catherine invited me to do a reading here, I was a bit alarmed. I thought, oh my God, with all those rock bands and my poems are so sort of airy fairy, what will happen? So bear with me. Okay, here's just one more airy fairy one. This is just in my own garden. I used to live in Highgate in London. So this is quite a whispery one, almost. What seemed so quiet when I listen hard is bird to bird, wheel on rain, what you say, I say. How tall the pines are, heads thinned, as though to hear what heaven says through wind. The harder grey falls, the brighter grows the dream of light. And wind, like rain, that is only heard as it meets our world on water, stone, or pain, wind, itself a silent thing you think will drown you out, well might, but also carries you the more to blow through open windows, like my own in Highgate. Thank you. You'll have to keep it up now, otherwise there'll be the jealousy syndrome. I'm going to, a bit further into the set, read some poems that are written in Persian forms. But I'm mixing them up with English forms, so here's a sonnet for you. I can find it. I was thinking, my dad came over to England many years ago, and that was the year the National Theatre opened on the South Bank in London, and I took him there, and we went up on the terraces, and he stood there with a rather sour look on his face, and I said, "What, don't you like it? Don't you think it's fantastic?" and all the rest of it. He said, "Oh, well, it's all right if you've got water." So this is thinking of my country, Iran, and comparing it with the lovely green of England. And this poem is called Eden. In this country, nature is green on green. In mine, green grows out of ochre, fawn, dun. What are the colours of dust? Caught between fruit trees, what are they but shifts of the sun? In this country, grass and tree are implicit in each other, as in water. In mine, dust and tree are awkward friends who elicit only the same blessings at the same shrine. But it's dust that deepens shadows, the tree that plays on colours watermarked by shade. When shade is deep as water, roots drink deeply, and drinking from the same pool, friends are made. If only we were dust and tree. My children, grown from my poor soil, I imagined Eden.
Thank you. Well, those are the garden poems. And of course, thinking of paradise, one inevitably thinks of our lost paradises. And I have many poems about my lost paradises, one way or the other. I came here as a child when I was 6 years old, and I didn't go back to Iran till I was about 17. And I lived there with my grandmother for a few years. And my memories, which were very, very happy memories of those 2 or 3 years in Tehran, living with my family really for the first time, seemed to me these eternal lost paradise. So here are some poems that are informed by those memories and images of living in Tehran. My family, I'll explain, as lots of old women for some reason, and I am very partial, well, being one myself now, but even when I wasn't, very partial to old women. And so that comes into this poem. But this poem started because my mum, who lived in London at the time, was going for a visit to Tehran, and she asked me to look after her plants. Now, her plants were these horrible little cactus things, you know, those miniature ones. And she gave me a whole tray of them and said, can you look after them while I'm away? And I don't like them at all. And when I looked really closely, actually, they were got lots of yellow and red and bright flowers on them, but they're all stuck on with glue. So I just couldn't believe it. And I don't know if she even ever noticed. So this is from a poem, a sequence of poems called Plant Care. Cacti need little water. Miniatures, barely a drop. A teaspoon each, she said, or fill the tray. It waits on the melodeon, crammed with tiny pots that are all in flower. Pinwheel yellows, tousled fists of red. So light, so dry, with a touch they topple over. Lack of estrogen makes women shrink. While tall, thin, white women, like Beverly, are prone to osteoporosis, small women like myself shrink even smaller. Our line of nonagenarians cobwebs our family tree, where small old women hang like drops of dew. Feed me stew and stock of marrow, beetroot sliced and sweet to swallow. Veil me white in flowery lawn, meadow eyebright, moth mullein. All bones and bones from yard to bed, all knuckled knees and lolling head. And when I move, draw back the veil, let death fly out and sing its tale. Left fist, right fist, which is the fist to hide it in? Sweet and joke and tethering rope, your navel cord and name. Left fist, right fist, fool's gold wishbone. Who's to know where the devil to dig? The ground all looks the same. Thank you. The next one, it's in the same sequence, all from Plant Care, is focused on the carpet seller in Tehran. Of course, Persian carpets are a mirror image of an image of paradise, you know, with all those birds and fruit and flowers and stuff. So my mum goes to Tehran and sends me a postcard. My mother's postcard shows a carpet stall where men in long white tunics, short blue waistcoats, are staring at a Farangi, foreigner, in a trilby and a Philip Marlowe trench coat. Above them, a plaque reads, Farsh Furushiye Ahmadiyan. That means Ahmadiyan's carpet stall. Pleasant and peaceful flight, arrived safely, happy I came, haven't been round the town yet. A town whose peeling skins of war await her, as Ahmadiyan himself might once have stood deferential in his fraying cuffs beside the beaded curtain. Befarmoid, after you. Golam, bring tea, a galion.
welcome. May your shadow at my door ever lengthen. Here is a sanctum, serpentine and cushion cool, where guinea fowl and golden hind wind on the banks of silk between us. Leagues of flowing patterns please us. Heavens themselves descend to earth, where stars may catch our heels. Sugar? May Allah bring what Allah wills. I tell no tales. May God protect your children. I was trying to actually get this feeling of what Farsi might sound like in English. Sounds decidedly strange. In an older dream I had, the wash basin was in a room, but also under trees, whose lower branches hung along the soap ledge. So when I ran the water, it took colour from the petals, pink and gold. And the water fanned carnelian pink and saffron gold, till pink and gold ran pale and spectre thin, and petals drained now lay like cabbage whites, and nothing I could do, no urging, willing, could make the water colour. Later, waking, I thought how even in my dreams I mutter, magic runs in holes they know nothing of in England. And next, I'll read a poem for my grandmother herself. And I visited Tehran after she died. And the last thing she did, my aunt told me, was, do you remember, well, some of you might remember sugar loaves, you know, these cones, like blocks of sugar, and they used to just chop them up to have, like, sugar cubes before the factory made stuff. And that was the last thing she did was break up the sugar, and then she had a siesta and died peacefully in her sleep. So I'm thinking of her back in London driving in the car. And this is called Rubaiyat. I'm sure you all know Edward Fitzgerald's translation of Omar Khayyam's Rubaiyat. So this is a Persian form, which is like four-line poetry. Rubaiyat for Telojun. Beyond the view of crossroads ringed with breath, her bed appears. The old rose covers, death has smoothed and stilled. Her fingers lie inert. Her nail file lies beside her in its sheath. The morning's work over, her final chore was breaking up the sugar just before siesta, sitting cross-legged on the carpet, her slippers lying neatly by the door. The image of her room behind the pane, though lost as the winding road shifts its plane, returns on every straight, like signatures we trace on glass, forget and find again. I have inherited her tools, her anvil, her axe, her old scrolled mat, but not her skill. And who would choose to chip at sugar cones when sugar cubes are boxed beside the till? The scent of lilacs from the road reminds me of my own garden. A neighbouring tree grows near the fence. At night, its clusters loom like lantern moons, pearly white, unearthly. I don't mind that the lilac's roots aren't mine. Its boughs are, and its blooms. It curves its spine towards my soil and litters it with dying stars. Deadheads I gather up like jasmine. My grandmother would rise and take my arm, then sifting through the petals in her palm, would place in mine the whitest of them all. Salam, dokhtar mahe man, salam. Salam, my daughter, lovely as the moon. Would that the world could see me, Telojun, through your eyes. Or that I could see a world that takes such care to tend what fades so soon.
Thank you. Well, a few more poems, and I'll reserve the form here I'm going to be using is the Ghazal, which is a very, very well-used, famous poetic form all across the East, and it originated in Persia. And if you think what the sonnet is to the West, then the Ghazal is the same to the East. And it's a short love lyric, and it comes in two-line verses, and it has one rhyme, so you hear the same sound coming again and again. And it has a refrain, which will be quite obvious. Okay? And in the last couplet, it's a very peculiar, peculiar to me, tradition, that it's called the signature couplet. And so the author has to mention herself or himself by name, which is terribly scary, you know, because it sounds like you've suddenly gone like egomaniac or something in English. Anyway, that's roughly speaking the form. And the most famous of the poets who wrote Ghazals was Hafez, the 14th century poet. So this is a version of a poem by Hafez, which I've done in English. Ghazal after Hafez. However large Earth's garden, mine's enough. One rose and the shade of a vine's enough. I don't want more wealth. I don't need more dross. The grape has its bloom and it shines enough. Why ask for the moon? The moon's in your cup. A beggar, a tramp, for whom wine's enough. Look at the stream as it winds out of sight. One glance, one glimpse of a chine's enough. Like the sun in bazaars, streaming in shafts, any slant on the grand design's enough. When you're here, my love, what more could I want? Just mentioning love in a line's enough. Heaven can wait. To have found, heaven knows, a bed and a roof so divine's enough. I've no grounds for complaint. As Hafez says, isn't a ghazal that he signs enough? I think I'll read a couple more of these ghazals. This one, I was sort of practicing them, and it took me ages till I could actually use my own name at the end without any kind of messing about. But this one I mess about, and I take Mimi from La Bohème and mention Rodolfo, who is her poet lover. Ghazal to hold me. I want to be held. I want somebody near to hold me. When the axe falls, time is called. Strangers appear to hold me. I want all that has been denied me, and more, much more than God in some lonely stratosphere to hold me. I want hand and eye, sweet roving things, and land for grazing, praising, and the last pioneer to hold me. I want my ship to come in, crossing the bar, before my back's so bowed, even children fear to hold me. I want to die being held, hearing my name thrown like a rope from a very old pier to hold me. I want to catch the last echoes, reel them in, like a curing song in the creel of my ear to hold me. I want Rodolfo to sing, flooding the gods. Ah, Mimi, as if I were her and he here to hold me. Thank you so much. And, of course, traditionally with the ghazal, because you know the refrain that's coming, it's the tradition that everybody joins in. So on this last one, I'm asking you all to join in the refrain with me, okay? And the refrain is, it's heartache. It's only a wee little one, okay? So I'll introduce it with the first two lines, and then please do join me. Ghazal, it's heartache. When you wake to jitters every day, it's heartache. Ignore it, explore it. Either way, it's heartache. Youth's a map you can never refold. From Yokohama to Hudson Bay, it's heartache. Follow the piper lost on the road. Whistle the tune that led him astray. It's heartache. Stop at the roadside. Name each flower. The loveliness that will always stay. It's heartache. Why do nightingales sing in the dark? Ask the refrain. It will only say, it's heartache. Let's chalvati, a quiet retreat, close my ghazal and heal as it may. It's heartache. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mimi. That was absolutely wonderful. Thanks for joining in, everyone. We do have time for some questions. Mimi, are you still happy to take some questions? So if anyone's got any questions, just stick your hand up and we'll get the mic to you. No questions? If not, I'll start off with a question. Can you tell us a little bit about the process of translating a poem from the Farsi into English and the Hafez poem that you read for us? Can you sort of tell us a bit about how that works for you?
Yes, well, I mean, I don't normally work as a translator, and of course I can't read and write Farsi, which doesn't help. So what I did is I had a friend give me a very literal transcription of the original, and then, you won't believe it, but that poem actually took me a year to write, and I have so many different versions of it that I don't actually know in the end what I ended up with quite. Very, very difficult, because to translate the meaning or the words or the sense is not so hard, obviously. But to turn it, to capture the music, and the ghazal is really all about music, and the meaning is carried with the music. You know, I don't think the words are that crucial. You know, if I would just say, bloody, bloody, blah, bloody, bloody, blah, hold me. Bloody, 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 blah, hold me. Do you see what I mean? You get the feeling of it. And that was what was very difficult, to do that and get the rhymes and get the refrain, which is why, and also I'm not an experienced translator, which is why it just took me forever and ever and ever. Every month I did two or three new versions, and it's very difficult also to convey both in a way the Iranianness of the original, but also the fact that, you know, many of these poets writing in countries that are less familiar to us here, such as Iran, the poetry is, of course, completely colloquial and idiomatic, even the 14th century stuff. So, you know, they're quite likely to say something like, oh, my God, it poured with rain today. You know, they're not going to say, oh, alas, what storms descended upon us, something or others. You know, do you know what I mean? And to convey that sense of the naturalness also in the English, I wanted to do that because to me that's also politically important to convey that it isn't so other and so alien and so strange and different, while at the same time it retains its own qualities. Anybody else?
Are the best poets of today from the West or from the East?
yes, I forgot. I've got a mic here. God, my question. That's really difficult. I'm so not an authority on Eastern poetry. But my impression, and this is terrible, I feel very guilty saying this, but I have tried to read some of the, I can say the contemporary Iranian poetry. I can't speak for Urdu and all the other languages. I've read in translation and sort of in my stumbling Farsi. And I have to say I prefer the English language poetry better. But I think it's partly because in those countries they're trying to make a break with their traditional verse forms and to break that grip of the rhyme and the meter and all that stuff. So they're writing this sort of more modern free verse. But we've been doing it longer over here and in America. So for that reason, I think we're ahead for now. But not in the classical. The classical sort of pantheon is fantastic, but unfortunately only available in really mostly awful translations.
Can I just ask a follow-up question to that?
Yes.
People who might be interested in reading more Eastern poetry and Persian poetry, where would you suggest that they start? And can you think of any translations that aren't awful?
Oh, I wish there was immediately, I could say, oh yeah, go to so-and-so. I mean, most people, I think, are familiar with Rumi, who's been at the top of the bestseller charts, I mean, not just for poetry, for everything, for like years and years in America, and he's been translated by Coleman Barks. I think the value of those translations is they are very natural and they read very sort of easily, and they have that sort of, like little kind of aphoristic, wise sort of quality to it. But of course, they bear very little resemblance to the original because they've completely lost the forms and the music and the rhymes and meters and all of that. But still, you get a feeling for it, definitely. I mean, personally, I think the best translations, Fitzgerald is like the most superb translation, even though he takes huge liberties. But I think some of the Victorian translators are still the best, actually, because they really were scholars. They knew the language back to front and inside out. And they did their best to recreate the forms in some way. But, of course, we suffer from the Victorian diction, so it does sound quite old-fashioned. But then if we can read, English 19th century poetry. I don't see why we can't read 19th century English translations. Yeah.
Clearly, you take quite a lot of forms from a Persian poetry, and you take sentiments and translations, but what other things do you take from your heritage into your poetry? That's difficult. This is a bad question, but
no, it's a very, very interesting question.
For example, is there a language feature that you think English people just wouldn't put into English poetry that you do, perhaps?
A little bit, because it gets a little bit technical here, but English poetry is very concrete. We stick very much to real images, not just grass, but this particular grass with that particular mud and that particular glitter from the spotlights on it. So it's very specific, it's very concrete. Whereas Eastern poetry will just tend to be grass is grass is grass. It's a symbol rather than an image. And sometimes I try and bring that over a little bit into the English. But other than that, I think it's more a question of sensibility. I mean, I think the Islamic sensibility in the arts is quite delicate, is quite lyrical, is quite weightless, and perhaps some of my writing has taken on some of those qualities. Maybe it's in the blood, I don't know. Anyway, I would love to write funny poems, but I've failed for 20 years to do so.
Thank you.
Thank you.
again, maybe staying with the same sort of territory about dual identities and belongings and so on, I was very struck in one of the poems that had the repeated refrain, in this country and then in my country. And I wondered, I mean, that is it as straightforward as that? I imagine not. But could you say maybe a little bit about the sort of sense of dual identities and how you think that maybe tension, relation, maybe the phrase of, you know, resident alien comes into my mind. How does that impact on the whole process of writing poetry? Is that a creative tension? Is that enough to get you, going?
God, yes, it's one of the huge questions, isn't it, that we all live with. And you're absolutely right. It's certainly not a fixed thing. So, for example, in that poem, I might say in this country and in mine. And in another poem, I might say in that country, i.e. Iran, and it's sort of over there. So I think this dual heritage and dual identity, first off, it's very, very slippery. It changes all the time. It changes according to the context and so on. It creates... Yes, there is a creative tension. Obviously, a lot of the imagery I draw from Iran and memories of my family and things like that. But it also creates big problems in how you're read and how you're perceived. So it's very difficult, you know, if I write a poem about roses, it's not because I'm fed up of all this hard-edged cynicism in contemporary poetry, so I'm going to be bloody radical and stroppy and write about roses. No, it's going to be because I'm exotic and I'm from Persia and it's all to do with Turkish delight and, you know, all that kind of stuff. Do you see what I mean? So how do you deal with that? You can't... Plus, you know, obviously I have a sense of nostalgia and that would come into my work. But then are you orientalizing what is already orientalized? It's very, very muddled and complex. I've no answers, but I feel very privileged and blessed, generally, when I'm not griping about something, you know, to have these two different cultures, yeah, to live side by side with or mingle.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You mentioned your love of old women, and I wondered if you could tell us something else, I don't know, about your grandmother or something that you learnt or hold precious from an old woman.
Oh, isn't that lovely? It's great. Nobody's ever asked me that before. Maybe I've never declared my love of old women so sort of bluntly before either. I don't know. I think they're just... great. I love the way that, you know, I don't know, just, well, they've lived a lot, and quite often there's just that sense of, like with my grandmother, she kept her own counsel, but you could see it in her eyes. You know, she knew what was what. She'd been there, done it, seen the movie, bought the book, you know what I mean? All of that. So all that experience with a hint of cynicism maybe thrown in, but a lot of patience as well. I mean, I particularly admired that quality in her. Plus, of course, she just loved me a lot, so I loved her back. And what else do I love about old women? I don't know, I just think they're very, generally very brave. I mean, I do think there is ageism in our society, and of course, there's sexism still, and you put the two together. So obviously, old women are going to get the brunt of it quite often. I mean, certainly I know that ever since I went white, I've sort of disappeared. You know, nobody looks at you. Can I get a drink at a bar? No, they looked straight over my shoulder. Yes, can I help you, sir? You know, sort of thing. So, but I think I admire their courage and their good humour and... there's a sort of sense of fellowship of some kind as well. I have a lot of poetry groups and workshops and courses, and the ages range from, you know, could be 22 to 80 or 85.
I know old women who go off and, you know, do an MA when they're 78. I think it's fantastic. Which is not to say men don't as well. But I just notice it more among women. It's not really a proper answer, and I'm not really going to give a very sort of politicised answer, because actually the way I feel about it is more just a sense of great warmth and affection. And not all old women, of course.
Mimi, it comes through in so many ways, but I just wondered how you nurture yourself as a poet.
Oh, by reading mostly. Yeah, I do read a lot. I go to readings a lot. And of course, the things that nurture you as a poet generally, I suppose, are very often life things, not poetry things. Do you know what I mean? So I was just sitting on those steps, staring out at the hills and the mist and everything, and you could sort of feel a poem sort of stirring there somewhere, you know, that kind of stuff. I mean, I like the natural world quite a lot, and then I like language itself. I like playing with words and things. But who knows? Yeah. But I would certainly put reading at the top of the list. Yeah. And reading prose as well, I mean, not just poetry.
When writing your poems, who do you write them for? Do you write them for yourself, or do you write to inspire other people or change the world? What do you write for? What is your main goal?
I couldn't possibly say I write to, you know, change the world or give people messages or something. Although I believe that poetry collectively has a power to create change or to sort of honour the language and to do all sorts of things. So I feel I'm doing my little bit in a huge kind of collective endeavour. But other than that, and I can't really say I write for myself. It's very difficult to know. I think I write for some sense of something beyond it all, you know, something beyond the thing that's I can see. Sounds a bit sort of spiritual, but I think there's that impulse, yeah.
Hi, I was wondering, what is the situation with poets in Iran at the moment? Are they finding it tough? Or
yes, very, 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 really dire for writers in general, including poets. The censorship is horrendous. I mean, many poets imprisoned, silenced, censored, though a few, for some strange reason, seem to escape it. I don't quite understand how that works. But of course it has a huge effect on what poetry is written, and quite a lot is being written and published. But it's all heavily, and it has been for decades, and I mean during the Shah's regime as well, you know, the censorship was fantastic. So I think that affects the nature of the poetry, because everything is then coded, and, you know, this stands for that, and everything's by innuendo and so on. So that's continuing. But a lot of Iranian poets are now in America and in Europe. Yeah. It's a very, very bad situation.
Any last questions? Okay, thanks so much, Mimi, for being here with us. I just want to draw your attention to the fact that we've got another poet coming on in about half an hour, Padraig O'Tooma. And also, I don't know if you've noticed, there's a little tent outside which has Padraig's story that was commissioned specially for the festival, printed on the inside of the tent. So if you crawl in, you can read his special Greenbelt story. But for now, can we give Mimi a very warm thank you for speaking for us?
Thank you very much.
Before you leave the tent, if you are wondering why I'm wearing this mask, go over to there. It's something that's not shown in the programme, but it's the people who are here from Fukushima who can tell you